Shalom, everyone. I'm Monty Judah, and welcome to our study in the Gospel of Matthew. We are in the midst of the study now, and in fact, we are in Matthew chapter 5. In our last study, Yeshua is beginning to do some of his teaching with the disciples. He happens to be up on what we call the Mount of Beatitudes, where he spoke there, and he also spoke to the incredible doctrinal issue of do not think that I came to abolish the law and the prophets. One of the items I didn't mention when we covered that before is this is one of the distinct differences between Pharisees and Sadducees. Pharisees believed that when the Messiah would come, that he would be a great Torah teacher, and he would actually make the Torah even greater. Whereas Sadducees believed that the Messiah was so great that he would overshadow all of the previous things that had been done, that God had done, like the giving of the Torah through Moses, that he would be so great that he would overshadow it. This was actually one of the differences. The Pharisees said, no, the Messiah will be for the Torah. The Sadducees said, no, the Messiah will actually render the Torah basically null and void. In other words, he'll be far greater than that. I find it ironic that most church people and most Christian teachers actually favor the Sadducean position on this. And you may have heard some people say that Yeshua came looking more like a Pharisee than a Sadducee. And the reason why they say that is because of this issue of how he regarded the Torah, the law, and the prophets. So here he is, and he's addressing the subject, don't even think that I've come to abolish it, I've come to fulfill it. And the word fulfill doesn't have anything to do with the word abolish, as I shared in the last program. And he makes mention of the Pharisees and the scribes. These are the men who taught the Torah and throughout the system. And he specifically says that unless your righteousness exceeds that of them, you will not see the kingdom of heaven. And the reason why he's making that is because one of the things that was distinctive about the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees, it was devoid of the responsibility, your personal responsibility of your heart. In other words, they just relegated them down to certain activities. Okay, if you don't kill the guy, then you're not guilty of murder. But Yeshua said, no, 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 in your heart, if you hate the man, you're guilty of murder already. And we all know from life experiences that if a person hates you, even though he doesn't get a stick and beat you to death, he can harm you in a whole variety of ways. He can harm you with his words. He can harm you in his other behaviors. He can harm you with what he does with your friends or whatever. And the harm done to you is very nearly as bad as if he'd have tried to physically kill you. And that's what Yeshua is trying to teach. And he's contrasting the teaching of the scribes and the Pharisees and saying, this is what they've told you, but this is what I say to you. Now, in our last study, we were here in Matthew 5. We're in the particular examples that he's using from the law and taking issue with some of the examples with the scribes and the Pharisees had been teaching. And one of the items that I read to you earlier, it says, therefore, if you are presenting an offering at the altar, this is verse 23, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar, go to your way, first be reconciled to your brother, then come and present your offering. You know what the Lord is really saying? It said, if you got a problem with another brother, there's aught between the two of you, you're disqualified in coming and trying to worship the Lord. He says, Lord, I don't want to hear from you. You know, I'm glad you want to come and worship me, and so we'll just leave it right here. Go take care of that first. One of the things that Paul teaches us in the book of Acts, herein do I exercise myself continually to have a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. And Jacob teaches us how you reconcile your relationship with God along with your relationship with men. And if you remember the conflict that Jacob had with Esau as compared to the Lord promising Jacob to come back to the land, that he would give him the land and the descendants, there had to be peace for things to work and go forward. It's not possible for him to return to the land with his sons if he doesn't find a way to take the acute problem that Esau has for him, and Esau wanted to kill him at that point, and resolve that, to get that down to some kind of level where there's not open conflict. Brethren, let me just say this to you, just as you cannot go through your life holding grudges with people and be considered faithful before God. Your spiritual life is on hold before the Lord if you can't get along with other people. Therefore, it's of paramount importance that you learn how to deal with that conflict, to bring it to some kind of peaceful reconciliation, forgive, forget, and move on, and so that you can have a proper relationship with the Lord. And here's the Messiah saying how essential that is to do that, how important that is to do that. I think there's a lot of people who don't understand why their spiritual life is not doing better than it should, than it is, and they think it should be better. And if they'd look around, there may be people that are having a serious problem with them that they're not addressing, or they have a problem with someone and they're not dealing with it either. They just, you know, leave it out there. And it affects you. You have to come to terms with it. You have to be reconciled to a certain level. Now, let me go ahead and just go one step further with this. I've been in conflict with certain people, and I reached out to them to be reconciled to them, and they rebuffed me. But I'm on record with the Lord that I extended the olive branch. I'm willing to be reconciled. I'm not drawing back or separating myself from that person. I'm willing to be reconciled the moment that they want to be. And that is how I've been able to maintain my relationship with the Lord. Now, had I said, no, I will never talk to that person, I'm not going to cooperate with that person, I'm intentionally not going to be reconciled to that person, then that causes a lot of difficulty in your relationship with the Lord. The Lord says, don't bring offerings to me. You know, go get that issue resolved. I wish this was taught more. I wish that the conflicts among brethren, that we could have a short sit down with the Messiah and have the Messiah repeat these words into every one of our ears, and so that we would be motivated then, let's go resolve those issues and let's be reconciled to the brethren and let's get about the business of what the Lord really wants to do with us. So that's my two cents while we're sitting here listening to the Messiah's teaching the disciples. And by the way, that's part of my purpose of teaching this book, is for you and I to walk along with the disciples and listen to the teaching of the Messiah and see how it applies to us as well. And maybe we could implement some of the things the Messiah was trying to teach the disciples in our own life. Amen? All right, let's continue on. verse 25, make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with them on the way, in order that your opponent say not deliver you to the judge, and the judge to the officer, and you be thrown in prison. If the conflict has gotten to the point where there could be real violation of law, you definitely want to be reconciled. You do not want it to get to the situation where others have to render the judgment, because you will be subject to whatever that judgment is in the matter. Verse 26, truly I say to you, you shall not come out of there until you have paid up to the last cent. And basically, if you take a conflict and you go all the way to judges of today, generally anybody who goes into the courtroom is not going to be happy with the result. As my father used to say to me, there are two places that you do not want to go in your life. One is a hospital, and the second one is a courtroom. it never works out for you. It's not good what can happen there. So that's Yeshua saying, avoid that kind of conflict. Don't take it to that level. Try to find a way to be resolved amongst yourselves. Verse 27, he's going to go to a new commandment. You have heard that it is said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman and to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out, throw it from you. For it is better that one of the parts of your body perish than your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off, throw it out from you. For it is better for you than one that parts of your body perish than for your whole body to go into hell. Obviously, the Lord is not saying pluck your eyes out, and he's not saying cut your hands off. Okay? He's not saying that. This is a metaphoric, very extreme metaphor, talking about that look to the reason, the cause of why you are being so tempted and why you're subject to lust. And cut that part off. Don't put yourself in that situation where you have a weakness to that for those kinds of sin for it. Now, that requires discipline, self-discipline. That requires you to take steps to obey the Lord. The commandments of the Lord, if you're really going to obey the Lord, require preparation on your part. They require you to do some things. Look at the example, say a young child in a home who's obeying their parents. Most parents will set up, for example, there's a series of chores that the kids are supposed to do, which is a part of being part of the family and so forth. If the kid takes the attitude, well, I'm just going to exist, then he's not really taking the steps to obey. He's not taking the steps to get the blessings, the benefit of his father and his mother. Usually there are things you need to do, like pick up after yourself, put your toys away, you know, bathe properly, brush your teeth, you know, all the things they give you as basic things so that you can maintain and stay in good stead with your parents and that you'll be known as an obedient child. It's when the child decides not to do those things, then they start getting him in trouble. Well, the same thing is true of us walking before our Heavenly Father. There's certain things that we need to do to maintain good order and for us to walk out our faith. If you think you can, well, I believe in the Sabbath, but I'm not really going to keep it. Well, I believe in the feast of the Lord, but I'm not going to go and I'm not going to be a part of the fellowship. Oh, yeah, I believe that we should contribute to, you know, a tithe, but I'm not going to give anything. You can go around saying you believe in those things and you have those things and you're still disobedient. You're not doing the right thing. What you need to do is you need to stop and analyze what the heck is happening that's causing me to not do the right thing. Oh, well, the reason why I wasn't doing the Sabbath thing is because that's the day I goof off and play golf and do other things. Okay, move golf to a different day. Do different things on that day and make yourself available for Sabbath. And you go right down through the list. That's really the teaching of what Yeshua is trying to give here. Take an active step in keeping the commandments. By the way, the word keep in the phrase keep the commandments, in the Hebrew, it's the same word for when you keep a garden. Now think about all the tasks associated with keeping a garden. You have to prepare the ground. You have to plan where the plants are going to be planted. You plant them. You have to water them. You have to feed them. Keep the weeds away from them. Keep the bugs off of them. You know, nurture the plant until you can gather its fruit and enjoy the benefit of the garden. There's a lot of tasks to it. You just throw some plants in the ground. You'll be lucky if you get anything out of it. You have to go work and keep a garden. The same thing is true of keeping the commandments. There are preparation things that you must do. Everybody who keeps the Sabbath, everybody who's in the habit of keeping the Sabbath, they know this one thing, that the day before Sabbath is called the day of preparation. that on the day before Sabbath is when you get the home ready. You decide what the meal's going to be, if there's going to be guests at your home, what are you going to be doing that day, and you plan to keep the Sabbath. You don't do the Sabbath by just being purely spontaneous. And that's an example of how you keep the Sabbath. You keep the commandments, you know, for that. And that's part of the understanding of how you learn to obey the Lord. Eliminate those things that are causing you harm to keep you from the commandments, and do the things that are positive that helps you to keep the commandments. This is the understanding that we believe that Yeshua has been teaching us all along. Verse 33. Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but you shall fulfill the vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of the feet, or Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, and anything beyond this is evil. So what is Yeshua talking about? In those days, and by the way, there's people who do this, there's a lot of people who overstate things. Now, what do I mean by overstate? They will go to make a positive, affirmative statement about it, and they go too far with it. Oh, I swear this is what's going to happen. Really? You know, all you had to do was say, I intend to do this, or I plan to do this. You didn't have to say, I swear to do it, because here's what happens. You go around making too many of those statements, making too many vows about things you're going to do, swearing you're going to do things. And so guess what happens? Circumstances happen, and the next thing you know, you're now not keeping what you vowed. You're not keeping what you swore to do. And here's the reason why Yeshua is speaking to this statement. There are, as you mature, you're going to find out there are three modes of speech. There's three time frames that your mouth speaks. You can speak to the past. And by the way, that's where most people communicate. They explain something they did yesterday or something like that. We mostly talk about things that have already happened. We explain things, you know, and we're really talking in the past tense, things that already exist. If you're going to get some work done, you have to speak in the present. You have to request something. You have to promise to do something. I request that you do the following for me. I promise I will do this in exchange for that. Or you, and by the way, request comes in different ways. You know, a military order is just a simple request, but it's in a military format. Your mom makes a request of you, tells you to do something. It's really a request that comes from mom, and it has its own authority structure that comes with it, just like a military order has its instruction that comes with it. If you are making a demand, you're not making a request. If you're insisting that something has to be done, you're ordering somebody to do something. That's not a true request. We don't go to the Lord and demand the Lord to do things. We make requests. We pray and petition the Lord. We ask the Lord. And asking of someone is a very appropriate activity. And that's how real work gets done. You promise, you request, and then there's one other thing, and that is for the structure for requests and promises, you will state facts. This is a truth. This is a fact. If you're going to communicate in the present tense, you're going to get something, some work done, you're going to get something accomplished, there's only three speeches. When I was in the business world and we came into a business meeting, by the way, business meetings in the business world are a giant waste of time. The reason why they are is because everybody's talking in the past, nobody's getting any work done. How you, as a leader, how you get them to be effective and to work is you make requests, you make promises, and you state facts. If you can keep the meeting at that level, work will be accomplished. And we'll walk away with action items. You'll know what you're going to do, and then know what the other person's going to do. That's how you get things done. By the way, what does the Messiah say to us as the dominant thing in our relationship with him? I want you to sit around and pray about how terrible everything is. No, I'm sorry. He didn't say that, did he? What he said was, ask and you'll receive. Ask. Get in the present tense with me. Let's do something about it now. Ask me about it. And a lot of people are afraid. They've never learned to ask questions. In fact, one of the things that a teacher will teach you is to try to convince you that there is no such thing as a bad question. If you're learning, ask questions. Ask questions. By the way, in a conflict negotiation, when you're in a real conflict in a negotiating thing with something very serious, don't make statements. Ask good questions. Get the other party to share information onto the table. You don't share information. Let them share the information. How do you get it out of them? Ask them good questions. That's how you deal with things. When Yeshua was at his trial, and they were dealing with him, we call that a conflict negotiation, Yeshua posed a question to the high priest. And if you remember, the guard there slapped Yeshua and said, how dare you ask the high priest a question? You remember what Yeshua said? Hey, I thought we were talking. When people are talking reasonably, both parties get to ask questions. And so rather than being afraid of questions being asked, that's how things really get resolved. That's how it happens. That's how it works. If you go into a situation and you know you have conflict with his brother, you know what? You should be your first words out of your mouth. Tell me, what is the problem you have with me? Share with me, why is there a problem? Ask a good question. Get something on the table that you can work with and start working toward a solution on. That's just basic wisdom. Let me tell you about the other mode, which is the future mode of speech. That's called a vow or a declaration. See, when you make a vow, you go into God's creation that he made, and you go in and you grab the future, and you take hold of it, and you drag it down to the present moment, and you alter God's creation. God says, I will give you the power to do that, but since you're altering my creation, I'm going to hold you to it. You make a vow, I will hold you to it. When we make a vow of marriage, we go into the future without conditions, and we say, I'm going to be your husband. She says, I will be your wife. And from that moment, the state of marriage exists. It's right now in the present with us. But it's all based on grabbing the future and pulling it down to the present. A lot of times, people think, well, I'm going to make a vow, but I'm going to put conditions on it. That's not a vow. That's a promise. That's a negotiation in a contract. I will do such and such, but you need to do such and such and so forth. Consideration will be given for consideration received. That is making a promise. That's making requests. That's not a vow. Now, that's what the Lord is trying to get people to do. Stay in the present tense and stop, you know, pulling everything from the future down to today, because the consequences of breaking your word by making a vow and a declaration is far greater than if you break a promise or break an agreement with another person. You break a promise or an agreement, you assess damages. That's the reason why we have courts. You know, we assess damages, the issue is resolved. But you start breaking vows, and it says God holds you to them. So what do you expect God to do to you? He's going to hold you to it. That's the reason why that when a couple breaks up a vow of marriage, there's no little perforated line where they separate. Where they separate from the other person. No, when they start separating, it starts tearing the fabric of their souls. because a vow includes your soul and your very life into it. Yeshua is trying to teach them, don't make false vows. Don't make vows for everything. Just let your yes be a yes. Let your no be a no. Just learn to communicate in that level so that people are not disappointed. You're not disappointed. You don't make mistakes. Be careful what you commit yourself to do with your mouth, because you're going to pay a price, you know, for it. He's giving very good counsel. And by the way, he's teaching what the Torah teaches. This is what the Torah teaches about vows. And he's teaching that here for us as well. Verse 38, he's continuing to teach on some other key commandments they have heard about. You have heard that it is said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist him who is evil. But whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn him to the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you, take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with them too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. Before I go any further, let's talk about this. The phrase, an eye for an eye, is a very interesting Hebrew phrase. And really what it means is the value you see with your eye must be equal to the value of this guy sees with his eye. So, for example, let me give you this example. I have a fender on my car. It looks perfectly new, looks perfectly fine, and I go out in the traffic, and you hit me, and you bend my fender. So eye for eye means you're going to fix my fender to where it looks like the original fender, so it looks enough so I can see the fender, and it looks just like it was before. That's eye for eye. That's what eye for eye. It literally means value for value. Sometimes you can't fix something. It's been broke all the way, and you can't replace it. Well, then that's where you assess the value of it, and you pay them the damages, and that's what eye for eye means. Now, it goes through the actual scripture, says eye for eye, tooth for tooth, bruise for bruise, wound for wound, and then it says this, but if the man is a servant, he shall be set free. What? Did you know the Torah has a special clause in this system, the substitution system, for servants, for people that are not at the same level with each other? And what it means is that if I was the servant of a master and the master and I, he hurt me, I'm instantly free at that moment. I mean, let's say I break a tooth. You broke my tooth. Now, he doesn't have extra teeth to give me, you know, to stick in my head. So what is the proper payment? I'm set free. You just lost me. You just completely lost me. And there, and I won't go into all the different kinds of applications of what this is, but this is a very, very significant provision of the law that most people have never heard of. In fact, whenever you hear somebody talk about eye for eye, tooth for tooth, why they think that's one of the negative aspects of the law. Oh, you know, it's all legalistic, you know, it's all eye for eye, you know, it's not, there's no mercy, there's no kindness, there's nothing in there. Boy, are they wrong about that. The truth of the matter is we want justice, equal weights and measures. We want eye for eye. It's the only reasonable way to get through this world with our neighbors. But it's also got a provision in there for if you do harm to someone who is not of equal status with you, then the law provides provisions for him because he's not at the same status as you, and he can be released from out from under that status that you have. And that, for a person who has some status in life, you should be very careful, because it will work out that if you have the means to pay, you may have to pay more. You know, lawyers go out when they sue you, they go suing you for your deep pockets. Who's got money? Let's sue that person. You don't go sue a poor man. He can't pay anything. But let's find the rich man that's involved with here, and let's go sue him. That's where the deep pockets are at. By the way, is that nice? No. Is it right? Yes. But if the man is a servant, he shall be set free. In other words, the guy that's the master over is going to pay more. He's going to lose more value in that negotiation and in that justice that comes forth from it. I know this is a controversial subject. I know that a lot of people struggle with this. But to tell you the truth, I have found myself in a number of situations serving as a judge and a counselor to brethren who come to me where there's been a misunderstanding and there's been a conflict, and they come to me, what counsel would you give about this? Where you need to look at things in a balanced way, eye for eye. What is the value seen here? What is the value seen there? You know, let's make a judgment where they are matching, they are balanced in that. That's the only way that you're going to have any chance of agreement on what takes place. A lot of people don't feel that they receive justice, and they're frustrated with justice. The truth of the matter is, there's a lot of criminals who, because they're poor, who suffer much greater penalties than, say, a defendant who's rich. Why do they think that's just? It's not. So as a result, it corrupts justice. Are they doing eye for eye there? No. It's a fraudulent form of justice. They're not following the principles of the Lord with regard to that. So that's what Yeshua's teaching was with regard to that. He talks about in here, verse 41, and whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too. It used to be in the days of when Yeshua was traveling around that if you were going to travel from city to city, let's say you were going to travel from the Galilee down to Jerusalem, you wanted to travel with several people in the group. And the reason is because there were thieves along the roadway, and a couple of his buddies, they would come up and accost you and steal from you and so forth. But if you had a group with you, if you had others with you, it was part of the defense. But if you were alone, oh my goodness, that was scary. That was very scary. And so it used to be the custom that if a man came into the city and he had purchased or done business there, and let's say that he was heading home, he would ask one of the people of the city, such as the merchant or a servant of the merchant, would you go with me, travel with me a mile out of the city so that nobody's lurking out at the gate watching for me to come out of the city and rob me? Would you go with me? Because that person would then recognize or identify any thief that might be operating in the area, and that would prohibit them or prevent them from being a thief. So that was the custom. You could ask of a person, hey, go with me for a mile. Well, Yeshua's going, he says, go too. You know, go out of your way to make sure they're secure and safe, you know, to do it. And that's what he's referring to. He says, when they ask you to go a mile, go too. And he talks about the other thing. If they want your shirt, give them the coat too. You know, go the extra distance to actually hurt the person. I'm not going to show you the verse, but there is a verse that talks about when we give to the needy, when we give to the poor, you're supposed to stick your hand out and don't bring your hand back until the need is met. And if it takes everything that you have, then that's what you gave. In other words, when you offer help, help them. I've seen a lot of people who, well, they don't deserve for me to give to them. You know, I've seen their judgment. They misjudge things. They squander what they have. They're not doing the right thing. And so I'm not going to give to them. It's like throwing money down a drain. That's not helping. And that's not giving the way that Scripture has taught us to give. And it's certainly not the way the Messiah taught us how to behave and help one another. And here's the Messiah giving all of these very personal teachings about how we are to behave with one another and how we're supposed to take that kindness that he was instructing us. How do we implement that? And he's taking issue with certain commandments that the Pharisees and scribes have taught that is contrary to what he's saying about the kindness that should also take place. Let's go to verse 43. You have heard that it is said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, sends rain on the righteous and for the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax gatherers do the same? And if you greet your brothers only, why do you do more than that? For why do you not do more for others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. There is a natural tendency on the part of us as mortals, as people, to be a little bit judgmental. And we also have this natural tendency to the good that I'm willing to do, I want to make sure I get credit for it. I want to make sure I don't get to do it that often. I don't feel motivated to do it that often, but I want to make sure I do it well, kind of thing. And so we don't really see the value of the other person. And we don't really truly help them. The people who know how to value other people, the people who know how to do this right, are the people themselves who've been in need before. And they know what it's like to be rebuffed by someone who doesn't want to help, and they know how appreciative they feel for someone who does help. I have always made this teaching of all the people that I've trained in the Lord, and that is the following. Before you can learn how to give, you must learn how to receive. If you will learn what you have received from the Lord, what he has done for you, you will not hesitate to give and share with anyone else. Because you will realize that you have received far more than you could ever possibly give. And so there should be no hesitation on your part to share and to give to another, because you know very good and well how the Lord has given to you. But if you're not aware of that, if you have not focused on that and come to terms with that, then you're going to be very critical about the idea of giving or sharing to another when they are in need. Because you don't understand that you how much in need you still are, and you don't know how to address it or deal with it. There's actually some advantage if you have been brought up in a humble setting and you've had to learn some of these lessons where those that were good to you, you saw how good they were, and those that were not so good to you, you saw how they behaved, because it gives you a very clear example of, I want to be like this person and not like that person. But more importantly, when you come to terms with what has the Lord really done for you, looking back on your life, has he been gracious to you? Has he been merciful to you? Has he done good to you? And you see it, you'll not be afraid to help other brethren. As Peter taught, such as I have, I give to you. Now, you can't give something you don't have to give. But when you do have something to give and somebody has need, why not give it to them? By the way, one of the things I've learned about the Lord is that if you give to others in need, you're doing the work of God, and God will give to you even more so. And so one of the things that the ministry that I've done is every time we have a kind of a downturn on donations and product sales and we're kind of getting low on funds, I know it's time to give. It's time for us to find brethren who need help. Let's go out and give to them. Let's help them out. Sure enough, works every time. And the reason why we had the downturn in the revenue is because we weren't staying on top of helping people. We weren't looking for the people who need the help. And we got complacent, got all busy about the work we were doing instead of what the Lord really wanted us to do, which was to minister to people. And that's just a ministry practice, but you can do that yourself. If you commit yourself to get out of yourself and go minister to other people, I can assure you, your life will be more full, it'll be more vibrant, you'll be happier, you'll enjoy the life that God gives to you by pouring yourself out for others you receive life, you know, from him as a result. And that's what he's trying to say here. He said, when it says you should love your neighbor, yeah, you should be loving everybody. And as far as, you know, hating your enemy, you know, if the only chance that they have to come to the kingdom is if somebody like you loves them or is kind to them. A lot of people who are angry people, a lot of people that are hurting people, the reason why they're angry and hurting and so forth is because they've been harmed. If you come along and you show kindness to them and are interested in helping them, sincerely helping them, they'll respond to that, just like you respond to it. And you can turn their lives around. You can turn them in a different direction. There is many testimonies of this, of people's lives who've been turned around because of the loving kindness of a believer who went out and followed the commandment of the Lord, followed the teaching of Yeshua, and reached out to people and loved other people. Doing good, when it's expected to do good, there's not much of a reward. Doing good when nobody expected you to do good, that's when you get a reward from the Master. I've shared some of this before. My career, when I was in business world, I remember one time in the engineering department that I was being interviewed for it, and they said, well, what job are you interested in doing here? And I think this was the Spirit of the Lord, and that was part of, you know, my spiritual instruction that I'd received. Instead of rattling off the standard things that everybody would say, I said, I want the job that nobody else wants. I want the work area that everybody else thinks is a pain in the keister. I want that one. You know what I discovered? If you go out and do the work in a job that everybody expects, you do a regular good job, there's no accolades for it. You do the job. But if you just go out and do an average job on an area that everybody hates and didn't want to deal with, you're a hero when you're able to complete it. Oh, man, you're a great guy. Oh, thank you. Thank you for... And by the way, in all of your interpersonal relationships, focus in on the person that the other people don't care for. Build that person up. Edify that person. You'll be seen in a totally different light, and you will help people tremendously. Even if you just spend a little time with them and help them out, the good that you do for the kingdom is amazing. That's what Yeshua is teaching. That's what he's teaching. He's teaching to do these kinds of things. Don't do what the other teachers have told you to do. You go and do good for it. Isn't what I just said a fuller understanding of the Torah than what the Pharisees were teaching? Yes, it is. He said, don't even think I came to abolish the law and prophets. I came to fulfill it. I came to fill it up full of meaning, so it would be more powerful, more effective, work greater in your life and the lives of other people when you keep the commandments of the Lord, to do where it produces positive, good fruit for the kingdom and causes the kingdom to grow and be nurtured. All right, we are now at chapter 6. We're going to get started with this chapter. Chapter 6 says, beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. When therefore you give alms, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, and they may be honored by men. Truly, I say to you that they have the reward in full. But when you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your alms may be in secret, and your Father, who is in secret, will repay you. Let me speak to that for just a moment. The rich people love to have big banquets, and they do charity dinners. You know, they come and they pay $20,000 for a meal at this table, and they get to meet some other celebrities, and they all get to wear their black ties and their tuxedos, and the wife gets to put all her sparkly stuff on and be seen with, you know, rubbing elbows and shaking hands with all kinds of important people and so forth. And they give this gift of thousands of dollars. And it's for a noble cause. So what do you think? You think they've stored up some treasures in heaven there? Not according to the Messiah. By the way, that dinner that you cheapened out for and the tuxedo, you got your reward in full right there. When you go home, you're done. That's it. That's the way you wanted it. That's the way you got it. Everybody, you know, rubbed elbows with you. You got to shake a few hands. Oh, that's great. Okay, but that's the end of the reward. As compared to the person who reaches in their need and helps someone, and in particular, does it when nobody expects you to do it, who does it many times in a secretive manner. One of the things that Lynn and I used to do earlier in our life was we had what we call a Lord's Fund. Sometimes we were at a place where the tithe that we would collect up, we didn't have a congregation we were associated with, but we'd go ahead and collect the tithe and we'd put it in this account. And we gave it to the Lord, and we called it the Lord's account. And what we would do, instead of contributing to a local congregation or something like that, many times we would run into brethren that were in need. We saw a lot of ladies that they were single parent families with kids, barely making it. And a lot of times we would go down and we'd buy a certificate at the grocery store for a bunch of groceries, which is just said certificate to this grocery store and how much it was valued. We'd stuck it in an envelope and we'd just put it in their mailbox. And this person would get it and they'd say, hey, I've got a certificate for these groceries. And who did this? Where'd it come from? Don't know. So you know who they would end up having to thank? They would thank God. Now, if you put your name on there, they'll come thank you. Now, if they thank God for what you've done, do you think the Lord takes note of that concerning you? Do you think the Lord takes note of the fact that you brought their heart closer to Him than you, that you taught them to thank Him instead of thanking you? Do you think the Lord takes note of that? I am here to testify to you, He does. And then He has a reward for you. It's not a reward that you'll get here. It's a reward that's being built for you in the kingdom. When I left my aerospace job and I went into the ministry, in illustrating this point a little bit, some of my colleagues, they were shocked because I was at the station of life where I could have joined other guys and started new companies and could have been millionaire. In fact, I had a personal financial plan that was I was going to retire at age 55. And when I left and I went into the ministry, a lot of my friends were like, what are you doing, Monty? I mean, why did you do that? And I used to explain to him, and I said, look, I got a better job offer, and I just couldn't turn it down. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I got this job offer in which I don't make a lot of money, but my needs are met, but my retirement program is out of this world, pal. And I work for the best boss I've ever worked for, the living God. And I get to work with the nicest people in the world, people that believe in God. I said, quite honestly, I couldn't turn the job down. It's the best job in the world that you could ever have. Now, I walked away from my, you know, big-time retirement program that I had planned. But I have not lost my retirement program. It's just that I pushed all of it forward and invested it in the kingdom. And I'm going to trust the Lord to figure out what that's worth. And since He has said to others who do similar things, their reward is exceedingly great, I'm trusting that the Lord knows how to treat me appropriately, treat me correctly, and I I don't want the reward here now. I want the reward later. I will be happy to serve here now and not worry about the reward for it. Whenever you hear a person who you ask them to help and they say, well, what do I get out? What do I get for it? Give them whatever it is they want, but that's all they're ever going to get from you. But if he says to you, oh, I'll be happy to do it for you, that guy is in a whole new special relationship with you. And you know what? You'll be motivated to do good things for him that is way beyond what he might have done for you. You actually get a greater reward if you're not concerned about the immediate reward. There is a very famous psychological test that was done with small children, in which they took these like preschool children and they set them down at a desk and a table and they put a marshmallow on the table. And they said, in a few moments, I'm going to walk away, but I'll come back. And if you leave that marshmallow there and you don't eat it, I will give you another marshmallow. You'll get two marshmallows. But if you eat it, no more marshmallows, just the one. And so they set kids up and they put it there, and it's called the marshmallow test, and they walk away. If the kid eats the marshmallow, they consider him to be learning disabled, that he can't understand future concepts. But if he leaves it there and waits for the second one, this is a kid who's going to learn well. This is a kid who's going to be successful through the education process and will improve and increase. We are all in the midst of a giant marshmallow test with God. You can either get your reward here and eat the marshmallow, or you can be patient, let the Lord bring you another marshmallow in the future. I've decided that I don't want to eat the marshmallow right now. And I encourage you as well to consider that. Again, the teaching of the Messiah to his disciples. When we come back again in the next program, we're going to take it up from chapter 6 and verse 5. We'll talk about praying, and we'll hear some of its instruction then. So, shalom all of you, and thank you for joining us in the study of the Gospel of Matthew.